First, the Department of Urban and Regional Planning at UW-Madison got a lot of attention over the weekend. The Wisconsin State Journal published an article about the department's struggle with sexual harassment surrounding a prominent professor. The article says the professor's alleged conduct had long been known in the so-called whisper network of women in the department. A survey on sexual misconduct at UW-Madison in 2015 revealed that about half of the responding female graduate students had experienced sexual harassment during their time at the university. About one in five of those who experienced harassment said a faculty member was responsible for the misconduct. Shannon Roski is an assistant professor in the College of Business at UW-Oshkosh. She joins us now for a look at sexual harassment on college campuses. Shannon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, with all the news of high-profile sexual harassment cases around the state, are you surprised to hear a story right here in Wisconsin on a big university campus?
You know, I've been studying sexual harassment for just about a decade now, and anytime I talk to anyone about my research, it seems that everyone has a personal story of either experiencing or being accused of sexual harassment. So at this point in my career, I'm never surprised to hear about a new instance of sexual harassment.
How big of a problem is sexual harassment on college and university campuses in particular?
It's definitely an issue. About 62% of all college students, that's including male and female students, experience some form of sexual harassment while in college, and that's only considering the students. College campuses are also a workplace for faculty and staff, and we know that 1 in 3 women and about 1 in 15 men will experience sexual harassment at some point in their careers.
Is it a particular problem on college campuses? It seems like we're learning every day that it's a problem everywhere, in every walk of life in this country. Is there something unique about it on college campuses?
Well, research suggests that there are certain factors like power differences or organizational cultures that might tolerate unprofessional or sexual behaviors that will then lead to sexual harassment. And if you think about college campuses, some of those factors are observable. So, for instance, there are power differences among administration, faculty, staff, and students. There are certain populations on campus, for instance, especially younger populations that might not have developed a sense of professionalism. Students might struggle to understand which behaviors might constitute harassment coming in out of high school, where certain things might be funny in friend groups, but they don't understand how it might impact someone's working or learning environment. Some of my recent research on sexual harassment also suggests that employees who frame sexual behaviors as playful or funny, that can blind people to the potential harm of these behaviors and thus perpetuate more frequent and more severe sexual behaviors being exhibited in the workplace.
In the UW-Madison case we referred to, the Wisconsin State Journal talked to two women who said they had experienced sexual harassment but wanted to remain anonymous because of fears of retaliation. Is that a common feeling to have?
So there are laws and university policies that are going to protect people from retaliation for reporting sexual harassment, even if that claim of sexual harassment cannot be substantiated with evidence. So if a person was retaliated against, that could be the source of a new harassment claim. There's the law, of course, and policy, but then there's also the real reality of experiencing retaliation. So even though there are protections against this, someone who's experiencing sexual harassment might still recognize, if I report, I could then be a target for retaliation, and thus they do the cost-benefit analysis and determine it's not worth it to them to make a formal report, even if the organization protects them from retaliation after it occurs.
Shannon Roski is with us from UW-Oshkosh. We're talking about sexual harassment on college campuses and elsewhere. And Shannon, a lot of your research focuses on the impact of sexual harassment trainings at the workplace, which is often offered as a solution when these problems arise. What have you learned about sexual harassment training and what kind of impact it can have?
Well, what's most interesting about the research on sexual harassment training is there's very little of it. So in terms of best practices, we don't know much as an academic community about what organizations should be doing in training. Some of the research is showing that there are benefits in terms of knowledge gained and maybe avoidance of certain behaviors. Other studies show There's no effective sexual harassment training. And in particular, a study that I conducted looked at some worst-case scenario effects of sexual harassment training. So I found that some employees who go through sexual harassment training were threatened by it. And afterwards, they ended up forming intentions to engage in more sexual behaviors in the workplace. They also formed intentions to avoid employees that they thought would be potential victims of sexual harassment and seek out employees who they thought would be potential harassers. So almost like creating subgroups within their work environment for people who would support the enactment of these sexual behaviors and avoiding those who wouldn't. And of course, that would pose issues in terms of sex-based discrimination in the workplace when you have the most vulnerable employees being the ones socially ostracized.
So it's a how-to guide in some cases for sexual harassers?
I wouldn't say that. What's happening, what I found in my study is that employees form norms in their work group before training happens. And so you might have a work group where people are already engaging in, let's say, sexual joke telling and have agreed amongst each other that this behavior is okay. Then they walk into training and they feel as though the training's pointing a finger at them and saying, you know, if you're involved in these sexual behaviors at work, you're either a harasser or a victim. Nobody wants to be either one of those roles. They're both negative roles to play. So this certain group of employees will backlash against the message of training. They'll deem the training illegitimate, a waste of their time, something that doesn't need to be listened to. And then when they return to work, in order to prove how illegitimate the training is, they'll engage in those sexual behaviors all the more to prove that they're okay in the workplace.
Is there something that works better or a better kind of sexual harassment training approach that avoids that reaction?
So we're still trying to figure out best practices in the research, but based on my prior results, I would recommend going with a more bystander-focused training. As I mentioned, it seems like this particular group of employees who's threatened by training is threatened by those negative roles that are imposed. When the trainer has a very harasser or victim-centric focus, they feel like those are the only roles somebody can play in a sexual harassment scenario. But the bystander role is a potentially really positive role to play. You can cover the same exact training content. For instance, here's a definition of harassment. Here are some behaviors to watch out for. And the difference might be instead of pointing your finger at the trainees and saying, don't do those behaviors, instead telling the trainees, hey, if you see anyone engaging in this in the workplace, here's some proactive ways you can intervene and stop that harm from happening. So instead of assuming all of the trainees are going to be harassers, assume that they're all potential bystanders and can actually help the organization create a better work environment.
And that seems like it would solve another problem where we hear of sexual harassment being reported informally or formally and being in some ways swept under the rug, maybe because the person it's reported to doesn't know how to be a positive bystander.
It's possible. Not everybody has the human resource management training to know what to do with a particular report of sexual harassment, especially if you're not in any kind of management position. You might just think, oh, they're just telling me this, and I'm not sure what to do with the information. That's why training can be really beneficial, because if we treat all of our employees as potential bystanders, we can give them training to say, here's how you could intervene in an ongoing harassment situation. Here's what you could do to help someone understand how to navigate the reporting system if they report sexual harassment to you after the fact, even if you're not particularly in a management position or if your job doesn't require you to be responsible for managing sexual harassment claims. We can still put employees in positive roles that help create a better culture around these issues.
We're talking to Shannon Roski from UW Oshkosh about sexual harassment on college campuses and about sexual harassment training and prevention in general. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced or witnessed sexual harassment on campus? How did you address the behavior? If you're on campus often, what's the climate like in your department? What do you think we need to do to stop sexual harassment on campus and elsewhere? Have you been through a training that you thought was particularly effective or ineffective? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation and get to your calls in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about sexual harassment on college campuses and elsewhere now with Shannon Roski from UW Oshkosh. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think college campuses can address problems of sexual harassment? What would need to change to create a more positive climate, a place where harassment is addressed and prevented on campus? And have you been through sexual harassment training, maybe at the workplace, maybe in school? What worked? What do you think didn't work? Call 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. And Shannon, let's get into that power imbalance you mentioned earlier. On a university, on a university campus, a professor with a grad student, maybe a thesis advisor, they have a lot of power over that person's career. They can single-handedly almost scuttle someone's career. Is that part of the solution, trying to deal with that power imbalance?
Yes, I think when you think of sexual harassment, what you have to realize is that power, not sexual interest, is the main motivator behind these inappropriate sexual behaviors. And so you might have a professor who holds formal power over, let's say, a student's grades. And if they make a sexual advance, they don't need to necessarily state an explicit exchange, you know, comply with this or I won't pass you in the class. It's implied just by the sheer fact that they hold so much power over a student. But power can also come out in ways you might not expect. So there's lots of informal forms of power, such as someone's popularity, expertise, or even their physical strength. For instance, I know of a case of sexual harassment on a college campus outside the state of Wisconsin where a university staff member was being harassed by male students while carrying out her janitorial work in the dorms. So even though she's an adult female with an official job at the university, her lower social class in comparison to the college students made her a target for mistreatment because she was the lower power individual in the scenario.
I want to bring on a caller now. John is with us in Indianapolis. John, hi.
When I was in graduate school, it was a professor who was having a lot of affairs with female students, and everybody on campus knew about it, including the faculty and administration, and he was tenured, and they said they couldn't touch him, but it was very disturbing that that kind of behavior was going on campus that was visible and then also off campus.
John, thanks for the call. A couple points maybe to get to there, Shannon. First, the idea of a tenured professor, especially if it's a big-name, high-profile professor, being unenforceable, basically, in the eyes of a university.
So I think that's a common misconception about tenure. Tenure is really there to protect the academic freedom of professors. So that means that the university can fire you for whatever it is that you're researching in particular. For instance, the university couldn't fire me for investigating sexual harassment training on college campuses. But tenure does not protect a professor from mistreating or abusing students or other employees of the university. In fact, a university or organizations in general are required to protect individuals from that form of mistreatment. So whether it's a big name, celebrity type individual or not, the organization is still responsible for investigating claims of sexual harassment and managing them. So celebrity is not an excuse or a get out of jail free card, so to speak.
But as we've seen again and again, that responsibility may not be taken up. In a lot of cases, this, as the caller mentioned, this open secret might be tolerated for years, decades even.
It's possible that what's resulting, and it's hard to know without knowing the specific details of the case, but oftentimes the bind the organization is in is they'll investigate and find that there's no evidence to make that claim legally actionable. So it's not that the organization is unaware or trying to sweep something under the rug. It's just that based on the laws and the organization's policies, there might not be any sort of disciplinary action that could potentially happen. And with something like a consensual romantic relationship like an affair, the issue might not necessarily be sexual harassment with the affair partner, but more of a conflict of interest with those outside of that romantic relationship. So perhaps the affair partner is getting special treatment because of that romantic relationship.
And Shannon, I wanted to ask about the role of the Human Resources Department. I think there's a suspicion sometimes, we saw this a lot in the case of sexual harassment at Uber, that HR is there to protect the company, not to protect the employee. Who does HR, a human resources department, really represent in these situations?
So I can't speak for how every HR department sees themselves in terms of whether they are there to protect the employees or the company. And I do have some colleagues that would reasonably disagree with me, but I teach all of my HR students that their role in HR is to do both, by protecting the employees from mistreatment and abuse, or even just bothersome interactions at work. We are going to create a healthier, happier workforce that is then more productive for the company. And this mentality will also help HR avoid unwanted lawsuits as well.
And Shannon, it seems like in the long run, we see case after case where the secret is prevented with the eye on, you know, avoiding a scandal in the short run. But when that scandal comes out a year or a decade later, it's even worse because they didn't deal with it up front.
Oh, absolutely. So the reputational consequences of organizations that are very publicly known to have a climate that tolerates sexual harassment, those are serious consequences for that organization. So you could see less interest in individuals wanting to work for your company. Of course, the cost of lawsuits, a less productive workforce, which of course costs the company money. So there are many costs to having that negative reputation.
Very briefly, Shannon, are you hoping for a silver lining in all these cases that everybody's going to be thinking more closely about how they handle these issues?
I guess if there is any silver lining in reports of this type of mistreatment, that would be it, that there's an increased motivation to research this subject, to find what the best practices are, and to help make workplaces and college campuses safer and healthier for everyone.
We'll leave it there. Shannon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Shannon Roski is an assistant professor in the College of Business at UW Oshkosh. She joined us to look at sexual harassment on college campuses and elsewhere after an article detailing one department at UW Madison that has struggled with sexual harassment issues.